prejudge him or abandon him. And what was the truth of what had happened? Impossible to know, unless he looked for it. "I think it's best if your concerns are mine," Jacob said.
"Are you sure?"
"I am." But he couldn't imagine Elizabeth ever trusting or forgiving a man who would defend a person she believed had hurt Emma and Claire. Nor could he imagine Elizabeth's face when, if he told her. What he wanted was to remember her as she had looked at him last night, her eyes shining with happiness and relief at seeing him. But his heart ached for her and all she had been going through. He wished she'd felt free to tell him last night about Emma and Claire, especially since he'd babbled on and on about himself. "But remember, Mother, this whole thing may be a mistake. Maybe charges won't be filed after all. We, all of us, have made a leap. Harley could already be freed."
"Didn't you hear the police captain say that he'd long had his eye on Harley?"
"Yes, but I'm not sure what he meant." Jacob left his mother writing her note to the Stips and went out to the stable to saddle Dolly. He turned the mare down Upper State in the direction of Maiden Lane and the magistrate's office. The noontime air was thick with the earthy promise of tulips and daffodils, though it was still chilly. Across the park there was a faint din and a cloud of dust rising above the row houses that were being demolished. But when he looked through the wrought iron fence in the direction of the Stips residence, he couldn't make out their house at all. It might as well, he thought, not even be there. Chapter 31. Across the park at the Stips, Emma and Claire held on to Elizabeth's hands as they ventured into the back garden. One of William's patients had presented at the house with an emergency, and Mary and Elizabeth had whisked the sisters outside. There had been no question of turning the man away. A metal lathe had crushed three of his fingers at the ironworks at the New York Central rail yards. Their clinic was closer than any of the hospitals, though in truth there was little William could do for the man here at the house, aside from splinting the mangled remains in an attempt to preserve them. Surgery would probably be needed, in the form of amputation, especially if the fingers turned gangrenous. Through the open kitchen windows, Mary could hear Vera humming, no doubt in an attempt to dampen the gruesome noises coming from William's clinic. It was Thursday. Amelia had gone to the morning prayer service at church, driven by Harold, who had been charged with posting a note afterward on Mary's clinic door, explaining that once again she wouldn't be seeing patients. Mary hated to do it, especially after the kindness they had all displayed last week, but she wanted to stay at home with the girls. Yesterday, when she and William had been rooting out Farrell, Emma had slept under Amelia's watchful eye, helped along by the chloral. But Claire had attached herself to Elizabeth and followed her around the house, asking again and again where her parents were. Elizabeth explained about the cemetery and promised to take her there, but Claire didn't really understand. Claire's misery had been hard for Elizabeth, and Mary didn't want to desert her again. This morning, she'd already had to leave for an hour to make her rounds at the hospital. Emma and Claire were wandering barefoot, walking gingerly on the cold green grasses, taking mincing steps, not venturing from Elizabeth's side. Elizabeth had brought out her violin case and placed it on a blanket she had spread under a maple tree. The girls' toes were already turning blue in the dew. They needed shoes, but no cobbler made house calls, and Mary certainly wasn't going to take them out in public. Not yet. Not until she had to. And certainly not today. Hampered by her stitches and bruises, Emma moved with greater caution than Claire, whose step was lighter. The two looked so much like their parents. They had Bonnie's beauty and David's lanky limbs, though their hair was their own. It glowed cinnamon in the sunlight, falling in a warm cascade about their shoulders. After the blizzard, the Stips had cleaned out the O'Donnells' rooms and donated their clothes to the community basket at the church. Yesterday, when Mary and William had returned from seeing Farrell, Amelia, in search of something for Emma and Claire to wear besides nightgowns, had gone there and discovered two of their dresses still in the basket. This morning, Emma and Claire had pulled them on with near reverence. Later, Mary would have a seamstress measure them for some new ones, but she doubted they would love anything as much as they did these remnants of their old lives. Their resurrection still seemed impossible. Yet here they were, making a tentative first foray into the world at Elizabeth's side. Elizabeth seemed to instinctively understand what the girls needed. Her touch, at once careful and affectionate, earned no reflexive withdrawal from Emma and Claire. Elizabeth looked over her shoulder at Mary and smiled her mother Jenny's conspiratorial half-smile, which Jenny would flash as a ceasefire in order to get through a rainy summer afternoon or a long winter evening. Now it seemed a ghostly benediction across time. Claire loosened her grip and ventured one step, then two, then plopped onto the ground, gathering the skirts of her dress tightly around her ankles. Emma, however, froze. After a few moments, Mary went over and took Emma's hand and coaxed her back to the stoop. Emma had not spoken a word this morning. Seated beside Mary, she made herself small, knotting her hands together, drawing them over her knees and pressing her folded legs to her chest. A single raised vein snaked across the expanse of her right cheekbone and disappeared into the ghost of the yellowing bruise. The dress that Amelia had unearthed was the pink calico that Bonnie had sewn for Emma last Christmas. Dense vertical lines of lace decorated the bodice, along with tiny pearl buttons that Emma used to finger at meals, or in the rare times anyone could get her to sit still. But she sat still now. David, Mary thought, would not be able to bear his scrappy daughter, whom he had encouraged to scramble up trees and dig in the dirt and laugh at anyone who scorned her, in so lifeless a carapace. During the war, her patients often wanted to recount the battle to her, to make her understand, but mostly they called for their mothers. Throughout that first terrible night at Antietam, when it seemed as if the entire world was bleeding, calls of mother had filled the air. And in the nights and days afterward, their keening cries obliterated even the battlefield gunfire. Emma had had 6 eternal weeks of difficult nights. Had she called for Bonnie? And how had she survived, with no mother to answer her call? A whisper of a giggle drifted across the garden. Claire was plucking early buttercups from a crop growing in the shade of the overhanging maple. Emma watched her sister intently, and Mary remembered Bonnie gazing at Emma and Claire with that same fierce love. "Emma?" Mary said. Emma shook her head. "It's all right. You can tell me." Emma hesitated, then turned to Mary and said, "Claire told. She wasn't supposed to tell."
"Tell about what?"
"He said..."
Emma closed her eyes, as if she were trying to shut out the memory.
"He said if we told..."
"About what happened?" Mary said, trying to encourage her.
"He said if we told, then something..."
A strand of hair blew across her face, and she absent-mindedly hooked a pinky finger around it and dragged it behind her ears. Before, Emma had been a chatterbox, a lively, bubbling font of intelligence and mischief. Now she couldn't even finish a sentence. "He said that something terrible would happen to Claire, didn't he?" Mary prompted. Emma pressed her lips together and nodded grimly, her eyes glazed with fear. Mary reached over and cradled Emma's pointed chin in one hand. "You're safe now. Do you hear me? Nothing will happen to Claire. Not here."
"You don't know."
"You're safe now." If need be, Mary would say this every hour,
every day for the rest of her life, so that Emma would believe it too. You're safe.
But you don't know.
Know what?
What he's like, Emma said.
Although Mary knew what had happened to Emma in broad terms, she did not yet know the whole of what she had suffered. However, from Emma's obvious terror, she had a suspicion of how they might have survived such a man. I think I might know, darling. I think he told you that if you did whatever he wanted, he would leave Claire alone. Is that it? Emma looked at her, astonished. Mary pulled Emma close and touched her lips to the top of Emma's head, not wanting to hold her too tightly, not wanting to scare her more. In the garden, Elizabeth was pulling her violin from its case. She and Claire were perched on the blanket, Claire leaning against Elizabeth's shoulder, one knee bent, while Elizabeth coated the bow with rosin. A hint of pine sap wafted across the garden.
You don't understand? I did something terrible, Emma said.
No, Emma, Mary said. You did nothing wrong.
But I did.
None of what happened to you and Claire was your fault.
But I killed him.
Mary drew back. What? Killed who?
The good one. I hit him with a shovel.
With a shovel?
He came downstairs when the bells were ringing and I was scared that he wouldn't let us go. I remembered Mama saying that bells like that meant fire or flood, so I picked up the shovel and hit him hard and he fell down and Claire and I ran up the stairs.
The words spilled out of Emma. It was the most she had said since she'd come back. But it still took a minute before Mary understood. At the hospital, she had assumed that something sharp in the water had injured Harley. But a shovel? Wielded by Emma? Is that how you got away? Emma nodded. How had the girl ever delivered such a devastating blow? But darling, you didn't kill him. You hurt him a little, but he's alive. Mary wouldn't mention now, or perhaps ever, that she and William had treated Harley. You didn't kill him, she said again.
I didn't.
No. Emma's eyes widened.
Then I'm not bad?
No, Emma. You're not bad. You're the bravest girl I have ever met. You saved Claire, and you saved yourself. Hitting him was the right thing to do.
But he was the good one.
Here it was again. Good man, bad man. Mary had been on alert since Farrell's observation the day before. Had there really been two men? Across the garden, Elizabeth lifted her bow, and the first sweet note of something beautiful lifted into the air. Why do you say he was the good one? Mary said.
He gave us food. Once he combed our hair.
But did the good man, the one you hit with the shovel, ever hurt you? Emma shook her head. He didn't touch you? The way the other man, the bad man, did? Mary said. Emma shook her head again, adamant. There were 1,000 questions Mary wanted to ask. Who was the other man? What did he look like? Do you know his name? But to push the girl now would be to suggest that she didn't believe her. And they hadn't heard yet from Farrell. What if Darlene hadn't been telling the truth? What if Harley wasn't the man after all? And two men harming Emma seemed easier to believe than one who stood by and let another assault her. Emma was yawning. This would be Emma's pattern, Mary thought. She would give up a few details and then collapse. She seemed to have acquired an extraordinary capacity for sleep, as if she had not slept the entire 6 weeks she had been gone. Vera stuck her head out the back door.
Someone to see you at the door.
A patient? Says he's the precinct captain. Mentel, I made him stay outside on the veranda.
When Vera was upset, her accent grew heavier, and it was heavy now. She turned and beamed at Emma.
How is our Emma today? Does she want hot chocolates?
I want to sleep.
Vera, warn Lizzie to keep Claire outside, would you please? Come on, Emma. I'll take you upstairs. Mary led Emma up the back stairway to the lying-in room, the little girl's hand clutching hers, with a lassitude that spoke both of exhaustion and indifference. Emma's eyes were already closing as Mary covered her with a light quilt and said, I'm going outside to talk to the policeman. If you need me, you can go to the window and call for me, all right? But she wasn't certain that Emma had even heard her. Downstairs, in the foyer, Mary could hear William in his exam room broaching the necessity of surgery with his patient, and the patient's anxious questions, the strain of pain and shock evident in the high, trembling pitch of his voice. William's even tones seemed to calm him, and their voices dropped to a low murmur. Outside, Mary found Mantell, pacing. He wore his greatcoat, though this morning the air had lost all hint of winter. He doffed his policeman's cap and said,
Mrs. Stipp,
without any hint of hostility.
Dr. Stipp.
She shut the door and stood before it to signal that she would not be inviting him inside.
Forgive me. Doctor, I came to apologize to you. I acknowledge that you were right all along. Those girls were alive, just as you thought. If it's any comfort, I thought you'd want to know that we've found the man who took them. With your help. It was Mr. James Harley who got your girls. Ironically, the man you stitched at the hospital.
He seemed to have added the last to share the blame, as if Mary were somehow complicit in his failure to locate Emma and Claire. But his manner remained subdued, with no sign of the bluster he had displayed in their previous interactions. Why didn't Officer Farrell come to tell us himself? We waited for him last night.
It was late when he got it all taken care of. I gave him the day off today. A man's got to sleep sometime, doesn't he? Plus, given how I behaved before, I owed you this courtesy.
Mary gave no indication that she accepted his apologies. She didn't. He'd behaved abominably, and she wasn't about to forgive him. Did Mr. Farrell mention to you that Emma and Claire say that there were two men involved?
He did. He also told me Harley needed a doctor. I arranged for Albert Vanderveer to go see him. The jail doctor isn't worth his salt. So neither you nor your husband should go near the man now. He is no longer your patient.
Do you know that the girls say that Mr. Harley didn't touch them?
Well, their imaginations...
Mary held up her hand. She was tired of everyone saying that Emma had to have imagined something she was so adamant about. Mary was even tired of her own doubts. If you speak to me again as if I or Emma don't know what we're talking about, I'll report you to the mayor, which is what I should have done the second you dropped your search. You ought to have gone door to door to save those children.
Your impression of my powers of search and seizure are prodigious, madam, but I assure you I do not possess the right to ransack Albany, no matter what you think. No regulation allows for such a blanket action. Something like that requires evidence of a crime committed. There was no sign of a struggle, no sightings of Emma and Claire that indicated anything other than that a tragedy had occurred, much like the hundreds of other tragedies across the Northeast as a result of that blizzard. Tragedies?
William had appeared behind her, having escorted his patient to the door. The man wore a sling, positioning his bandaged hand high across his chest. Dazedly, He stumbled past the policeman and wandered off toward the horse car stop a half block away, where he sank onto the slatted bench to await the next car.
"How do you do, Dr. Stibb?"
Mantell said to William, after turning to watch the man go.
"Your wife seems to be worried I won't be doing the work to hunt down whoever is responsible for what happened to those girls, but I will. You can count on it. And I assure you that we'll be asking Mr. Harley if he had a friend. But he's in no shape to talk just now. Albert Vanderveer went to see him in jail, and he reported the man is feverish. Right now, I'd like to talk to your girls, to see if they can describe the man who kidnapped them. If that's what happened."
"It is what happened," Mary said. "You just said Harley took them."
"Right. Yes, well, everything's alleged until proven in court. I'm just being careful here. Now, can I talk to the girls?"
"Absolutely not. Not yet," Mary said. "Emma can barely stay awake, and Claire is young. She calls Harley the good man, and the second one the bad man. Actually, both of them do."
"Can you tell me anything? How are the girls feeling?"
"How do you think they're feeling, Captain? I examined them both. The evidence is unmistakable. Emma was raped, but Claire was not. She was spared."
"Spared?"
"Completely." Mantell whistled through his teeth.
"I wonder what that's about."
"Don't be obtuse. You know exactly what that's about," Mary said, unleashing her full anger. He was pretending to know very little, his previous cavalier reference to the matter seemingly expunged from his memory. It was infuriating. "It's just as you said before. Claire is not of age, but Emma is. Whoever raped her knew that, and acted accordingly." Squinting against a sudden shaft of light streaming under the portico, Mantell registered Mary's statement with a vague, grim nod. On the street, the horse car plodded past and slowed to a stop. They all turned to observe William's patient ascend the open stairs, his gait far steadier than before.
"Well," Mantell said when the car started up again, "the district attorney will probably file charges against Harley soon. He'll need to talk to the girls within a few days, too, so get ready. And he'll be asking you what you want to do. Have you talked about that?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, if this goes to trial, Emma and Claire will need to testify. Have you thought about that?"
Mary exchanged a look with William. They'd been too busy taking care of the girls to consider the possibility of a trial, and what it might mean for Emma.
"Well, I'll be leaving you for now,"
Mantell said, replacing his cap.
"But one last warning. This story is fair game for the newspapers. Get ready. Like I told Farrell, it's not every day two children come back to life."
With that, the brawny man tipped his hat and clattered down the steps, making an ignoble, hasty retreat down the slate walkway and across the street to the uneven sidewalk that ran outside the park fence. As he turned into the park, he passed Harold and Amelia returning from church. Harold dropped Amelia in front. She strode up the walkway, brandishing a copy of the Argus, its headlines blaring that the Winter sisters had been found alive, that James Harley had been arrested for their kidnapping and ravishment, and that the girls were so crazed by their ordeal that they had been interred in a sanitarium.
"How can it be announced in the newspapers already?" Amelia said, sinking breathless onto the veranda swing. "How does the reporter even know? Especially what happened to Emma? We told no one, and a sanitarium?"
William and Mary stared at one another. It seemed impossible that the sympathetic Farrell would leak the news before they gave him permission. Only later that afternoon, when they received Viola's letter with its generous offer of shelter and help for Emma and Claire, did they learn that Captain Mantell, astonishingly, had stopped first at the Vanderveers to inform them of James Harley's arrest before coming to tell them. Who else, they wondered, had he told?
Chapter 32. A letter for Elizabeth from Jacob arrived early the next morning, Friday, April 25th, via a Vanderveer footman before any of them had even breakfasted. Jacob had never come to claim her for the walk he had promised her, and she expected that this cream-colored envelope with its clear, flowing script was an apology. She took the envelope upstairs to her room and tore it open. Midnight, Thursday, April 24th. Dear Elizabeth, I apologize profusely for not coming to call on you this week. I intended to come to see you today. However, the entirety of my attention became embroiled elsewhere, and I confess that I forgot our engagement until this late hour. So I am writing you now with my sincerest and most heartfelt apologies. And I fear that after I tell you what occupied my attention so completely, you may never want me to call, ever again. I would prefer to tell you the news I am about to relay in person. However, I do not wish to disturb Emma and Claire O'Donnell. Yes, I know now what caused you so much distress the last time we saw one another. Early this morning, Captain Mantell came to inform my father of all the news. It is this event that diverted my attentions. My father has induced me to represent Mr. James Harley. Therefore, today, became consumed by a visit to the county jail and then a bail hearing. You may perhaps learn tomorrow that the judge has refused Mr. Harley bail. He is to be held pending charges. The district attorney will soon decide whether or not to file, I expect within the next 48 hours. I realize my involvement in the case will come as a shock. What I pledge to you and your family is that if Mr. Harley does go to trial, I vow to take enormous care with Emma and Claire in court. My own shock upon learning of the crimes committed against them cannot in any measure approximate yours, but I assure you that my heart is with you and your family, even as I pay duty to mine. I will understand if you wish to never see me again, though I am heartbroken at the prospect of losing your regard. I remain yours most sincerely, Jacob Vanderveer. Elizabeth laid the letter open on the bed beside her and looked out the window and across the park. She could not see the Vanderveer mansion, and for that she was glad. Even if the park's saplings had not already been budding, the distance was too far, though since meeting Jacob, she had often fancied that she could just make out the mansion's distinctive height. After a few moments, she retrieved the letter and went downstairs into the kitchen, where to Vera's surprise, she pried the burner off the cook stove and shoved the letter into the fire.
Chapter 33. In the next several days, speculation in the newspapers about Emma and Claire and James Harley echoed a rising hysteria in the city, to be expected, perhaps, in a place still reeling from the effects of the flood. The Stipps heard nothing from the district attorney. They spent their time at home, tending to the girls, seeing their patients, trying to ignore the clusters of the curious who gathered on the sidewalk across the street, their heads tilted together in gossip, occasionally pointing toward the house. On Sunday, they did not go to church. It was not until Monday that they received a request for an interview from Lansing Hotaling, the district attorney. He arrived at the Stipp house on Tuesday morning, after sending a second note to arrange the time of the appointment. He specifically needed to question Emma, he wrote, to precisely understand the case. It was imperative that he speak with her before she forgot any details.
He would not question Claire, he wrote, for she was far too young and unreliable by the standards of the court to provide crucial testimony. Mary and William met him at the door. Hoteling was about 30 years of age and nearly 7 feet tall. He had to duck under the door lintel. When viewed from the side, his long frame resembled a question mark, bringing to mind Washington Irving's lanky Ichabod Crane. Juggling a sheaf of papers and a carrying case, he shook William's hand with a large, damp grip. His wrinkled frock coat was expertly tailored, but bunched at his elbows, and several brown stains marred the yellow silk of its turned cuffs. Though he wore a wedding ring and his trousers were neatly pressed, the overall impression was of a man who needed someone to take care of him. He took a seat on a chair in the parlor and arranged his papers on the low table marred with the nicks and gouges of years of waiting patients and their restless children. Clasping his large hands in an attitude of prayer, he began,
"You have only to read recent newspaper articles to ascertain that if we go to trial, this case will pose difficulties for everyone involved." "Have you filed charges yet?"
William asked.
"No, and I'm not certain whether or not I will. Emma's responses today will give me a good sense of whether or not I can even bring a case, and what sort of case I can bring. Kidnapping is straightforward enough. I'll probe that issue with her first. What is in question is the other charge, which has obviously, in breach of the rules, already been leaked to the press. We think Captain Mantell may have been responsible for that," William said. "The police captain? I'll note that. Now, if indeed Emma is a victim of indecencies..."
"She is," Mary said, "without equivocation. I can readily detail the injuries I found on exam that directly point to..." The district attorney stopped her with one long hand.
"Please, Mrs.—"
"Doctor," Mary said.
"I will gladly hear what you have to say, Dr. Stipp, but only after I speak to Emma. I do not want to contaminate my impressions with yours."
"They are not impressions, they are facts."
"There are facts, and then there are alternate facts."
"That is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard anyone say."
"Be that as it may, correct procedure must be followed."
"We insist on being present when you speak with her," Mary said. "She has not been talking much, nor do I press her for details that she cannot yet give. She is in a precarious state. My goal, my mother's goal, my husband's, has been to make her feel safe. It is a minute-by-minute process."
"Fine. One of you may stay, but you will not prompt her in any way. Do you understand?"
Amelia escorted Emma in, the girl shuffling, careful of her stitches. She was worrying one of the minute pearl buttons of her dress with her fingers. Yesterday, when they'd told her that someone would come to ask her questions, she'd responded with silence. Mary lifted Emma onto her lap as William and Amelia retreated to the hallway, hovering just out of sight. Elizabeth had again taken Claire to the back garden with a diversionary picnic. Hoteling's face was a mask of trained disinterest. He explained to Emma why he was there and what he needed her to do. It was important, he said, that she answer every question, because he wanted to understand. Could she do that? She nodded, her eyes moving from his long fingers to his narrow face. Hoteling began, balancing a small lap desk he'd brought with him on one thigh, his legs crossed, a notebook open and at the ready, a newly shaved pencil twirling in the long fingers of his left hand.
"All right, we'll begin. How old are you, Emma?"
10.
"How old is your sister?"
7.
"Can you tell me what happened when the blizzard ended?"
"We went outside when the teacher said to go home. But Mama and Papa weren't there," Emma said, her voice breaking.
I know this is hard, but you must answer every question I ask you, even when you're sad. Do you understand?
Yes.
When your parents didn't come for you, what did you do? Did you go back into the school?
No. We thought they were coming, but they didn't. And then we wanted to go home.
There must have been a lot of people outside, other parents and so on. Did you ask someone you knew for help?
They all left us.
Again, did you think of going back to the school?
The teacher said we couldn't. She said we had to go home because she didn't have any food for us anymore. We were hungry. We just wanted to go home.
How long did you wait?
I don't know. It was so cold.
What happened next?
We started to go home, but the snow was too deep.
Mary shuddered at the thought of Emma and Claire trying to maneuver through those terrible drifts.
Then what happened?
Claire sank, and I couldn't dig her out.
Where were you?
At the intersection of our street.
And what happened next?
A man stopped. He was in a sleigh. He said he would help us. He dug Claire out.
Did you know him?
No.
Mary was astonished. Emma had barely responded to anything they had asked her.
What did he look like?
Emma buried her face in Mary's chest and would not answer.
All right, Hoteling said. Can you tell me whether you had ever seen him before?
Emma shook her head.
Can you at least tell me his name?
The other man, she said.
He didn't tell you his name?
No.
Why did you call him the other man?
Because there were two men.
There were two men in the sleigh?
No. Just him.
Then what happened?
He put us in his sleigh.
Why did you let him?
He said he would help us.
Emma was trembling now.
Did you ask to go home?
I thought he knew where we lived.
Where did he take you?
To a house near the river.
Then what?
He went inside and left us outside.
Why didn't you go home?
The snow was too deep.
Then what?
He came outside and took us in, and the man was there.
The man?
Yes. It was his house. And he fed us and took care of us.
What was his name?
He never said.
What did the other man do then?
He left. But sometimes he came back, and he...
What?
He hurt me.
What about the one you call the man? Did he hurt you?
No. He never did. He took care of us. He gave us baths and fed us. He was nice.
How did the other man hurt you?
Hoteling had given off taking notes now. He'd softened his voice, too.
The reason I want you to tell me is so that you and I can tell the court the truth and he can be punished. Do you understand?
The litany of questions that followed felt to Mary like a battering ram. Hoteling asked questions she had not yet dared to ask for fear of Emma's fragile state. From moment to moment,
It was impossible to know whether she would answer even a simple question requiring only a yes or no answer, to say nothing of more complicated inquiries. But she did. Mary wanted to protect her from all of it, but Emma answered one after the other, sometimes with stilted clarity, sometimes with a despairing shake of her head. Any time Mary protested, which was often, Hoteling insisted that she allow him to do his job. There are aspects of law that are distasteful, just as there are in medicine. Did he interfere in her work? He pressed on. Did this other man come in the day or at night? How many times a week? You don't know. Was he short, tall, fat, thin? What was his hair like? His beard? Why don't you know? Why can't you say? Perhaps you played make-believe because you were bored. Made him up. Did you fight him off? How hard? Most girls would rather die than submit. They would fight until the death. He threatened your sister. Did he ever hurt her? Then why did you believe he might? He said so. But those are just words. Show me where he touched you. You have to, Emma. All right, then. Did he ever put his member inside you? At this point, William stole into the room and stood behind the district attorney, locking eyes with Emma in an effort to instill courage. You don't know. Have you ever had sexual congress with anyone else? It's when a man or a boy puts his member inside you. Not at school? Maybe in an alleyway? No? But did you want to? Are you telling the truth? How did you get away? With a shovel? Did you want to kill him? Which man did you hit? Are you sure? When Hoteling said he was finished, Mary handed over a limp Emma to Amelia, who bore her away in her arms, promising hot chocolate and cake and more sleep if she wanted it. What was that? William raged, after they heard the kitchen door latch shut behind Amelia. Hoteling was juggling his notes into his carrying case. He looked up, exasperated.
My interest as prosecutor is in convicting criminals, not in protecting witnesses. Do you know what you just put her through? You should be grateful I'm even prosecuting, considering the challenges. I was already committed to lodging the kidnapping charge. I just needed to verify. And though it could be argued that Emma and Claire went willingly, it's apparent that they had a different idea of this other man's motivation. My object today was to decide whether or not to pursue rape charges. You understand that to win a court case that alleges rape, I have to prove, unequivocally, that Emma suffered unwanted penetration. Prove it. In stark, unvarnished, eminently credible, incontrovertible evidence. Sometimes girls say that men have raped them when they have not. That is utter nonsense.
Hoteling held up a cautioning hand.
Let me finish. It was my job today to ascertain the veracity of my witness. My witness, not yours. It's interesting that Emma says that whoever it is didn't rape Claire. Rape would be far easier to prove if Emma herself were underage, but she is not. In order to make my case, Emma has to perform perfectly in court. Perfectly. She cannot make a single mistake. She has to be strong enough to undergo the ugliness of a trial like this one, because this one will be ugly. If she cannot withstand the barrage in her own home, then she certainly won't be able to in open court. I would be a laughingstock for bringing the case, and in the end, it would all be for naught, and then where would we be? No justice, no resolution. So, do not tell me that I do not know my job. I had to ask those questions. Now, as I see it, there are several extenuating issues with this case, one of which may be difficult to navigate. Emma survived. It's very difficult to justify a rape charge when the girl wasn't killed. In court, survival is considered an indication of acquiescence.
Mary shot out of her chair. Are you out of your mind? No child would acquiesce to what happened. She then listed, graphically, every detail of Emma's injuries, down to the last stitch, using merciless language intended to unseat hoteling with its precision. Taking a sheet of paper from hoteling's pile, William wrote down everything she said. When Mary finished, hoteling accepted the sheet of paper from William and added them to his haphazard sheaf of papers.
Unpalatable as they are, doctors, these physical injuries in and of themselves do not in fact prove rape. With a young girl like Emma, they prove only intercourse. Do they not? Her size? The comparative...
He cleared his throat.
Ratio?
Dear God, Mary said. While it was true that because of Emma's size, she would have sustained the same injuries had the intercourse been consensual, that was completely beside the point. You've completely missed the fact of her many bruises.
In court, hoteling shrugged, rape is proved by evidence of concerted and prolonged physical resistance until the victim's death. She was hit, apparently, but one can survive blows. In turn, she defended herself with a shovel, but he did not die. It would be better if he had. A fight to the death. As it is, under these circumstances, the defense could suggest that Emma was not raped. That she participated, then repented her immorality, and staged an attempt at full resistance as a ruse, but in reality did not wish to kill her lover, and so spared him. The bruises do help us, but given your relationship to the O'Donnell girls, the defense will challenge your impartiality as an unbiased witness. You should have taken her to another doctor to be examined. But that can't be helped now.
Emma was raped, Mr. Hoteling, without a doubt.
That's my job to prove, isn't it? We will have to see how clever this young pup Jacob Vanderveer proves to be. Do you know him?
We do. Mary said.
Well, he's out of his depth. He's never tried a case before, except as a student at Harvard, where they lean on torts and constitutional law more than trial procedure, as I well know.
You went to Harvard?
I did. The other possibility is that Emma could be charged with assault. However, you'll be happy to know that I am the one responsible for filing such charges, and I will not be following through.
What?
This is a complicated situation.
It is as straightforward as they come.
It will be my job to make it seem so in court. You'll be happy to know that as a result of this meeting, I have now decided to file charges against James Harley for kidnapping and rape.
But what of the other man? You heard Emma say,
with all due respect, Emma couldn't even tell me what Harley or this so-called other man looks like. It's a good thing she hit Harley, because at least we have his wound as identifier.
But there is no substantial evidence that another man even exists.
This morning, before I came here, I interrogated Mr. Harley. He denies that there was anyone else, which is telling, because usually a defendant will do everything he can to deflect blame. And even though Officer Farrell shares your suspicions, I would be a fool to try to chase down a fictitious second man, whom even the defendant swears doesn't exist. And the only evidence Emma has offered is a rather murky description, and I have to tell you, a jury consists of men, and men will believe a man. Especially a defendant who could save himself by naming someone else over a brutalized girl any day. But no matter. I'll craft my questions in such a way as to skirt her delusion that there was another man. Shouldn't be hard.
Isn't it possible that Harley is protecting someone? William said.
Would you have me pursue a ghost, or make certain that Harley is incarcerated? At the very least, he kidnapped those girls. and imprisoned them, I think. I believe he raped Emma. I do, or I wouldn't be attempting to convict him.
He began stuffing his case again with papers.
There is another thing,
he said, folding the flap of his case and setting it on his lap.
I've had reports that you, Dr. Stipp,
he nodded at Mary,
have been performing abortions at that clandestine clinic of yours.
I haven't, Mary said. William stood.
Where did you hear such an outrageous thing?
Hoteling shook his head.
I can't say. But understand, doctors, that I take such allegations seriously.
Rumor, Mary hissed. Not allegation.
I had to ask. Now, Emma will be a witness. You must make certain that she's ready.
Ready how?
Warn her of what might happen in the courtroom. It won't be comfortable for her.
What if we refuse to put her through it? What if we drop the charges?
They are no longer yours to drop. Your chance to end this has passed. If you didn't want her to have to testify, then you ought not to have reported the crime. Many women don't. But you did. And now it's my job to convict the perpetrator. Good day. I'll find my own way out.
If this breaks Emma, Amelia said, leaving the statement unfinished. They had put the girls to bed. Mary was staring off over the table into the back garden, lifting and replacing a spoon from the saucer of her teacup. William and Elizabeth were fingering the gold rim of their cups. Amelia was studying a berry stain on the white tablecloth. Vera had made a strawberry pie from tiny, early fruit that she was growing in a sunny corner of the garden. The trial was out of their hands. The train they could not stop. Chapter 34. The Court of Sessions tried the county's criminal cases 5 times a year in the venerable City Hall courtroom that they shared with the Supreme Court, Circuit Court, and the Court of Oyer and Terminer, which occupied the chambers at other times, meaning that the earliest Harley's trial could take place was during the Court of Sessions' next residency, beginning on the third Monday in June. The charges finally filed against him numbered 3, kidnapping, imprisonment, and rape. These charges each carried a sentence of not less than 10 years. If Harley were convicted on all counts, he could spend the rest of his life, or at least 30 years of it, in the Albany Penitentiary, which was situated by some mean twist of fate, a quarter mile behind the Stipp's home. The ever-voluble Horace Young blared all this information in yet another extra edition of the Argus that hit the streets at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the second day of May, a Friday, 3 days after Hoteling's first visit to the Stipps. The edition sold out within an hour, helped along by a featured quote from Lansing Hoteling, who, upon exiting the courthouse earlier that day, had declared that the city was after blood. All told, Horace Young's articles had already earned the Argus twice its usual revenue for the year. But over the almost 8 weeks since Emma and Claire O'Donnell's reappearance, the 12 newspapers in Albany had joined in the scandal-mongering. Never had the city's publishing coffers been so full. Incensed by the unending stream of articles, the Honorable Julius Thayer of the Court of Sessions pushed the People versus James Harley to the front of the docket. And so the day was set. On Monday, June 16th, the grand jury would hear District Attorney Lansing Hoteling's evidence. And if the jury handed down an indictment, the trial would begin immediately afterward. On Tuesday, May 6th, Jacob met with Lansing Hoteling at his office in City Hall to discuss the possibility of a plea bargain. Hoteling received Jacob without getting up from his desk. His airless office occupied a room on the second floor of the white marble building and had a north-facing window that he declined to open. The district attorney leaned back in his seat and tented his hands.
Absolutely not. No plea bargain. Insufficient blood is let in plea bargains.
Having discharged the sole reason for his visit, Jacob saw no reason to stay. He rose to leave to make his second visit to Harley in jail, but hoteling waylaid him. He had a few other things to tell the young attorney. By the time hoteling was finished, Jacob was shaking with rage. Jacob had first visited Harley more than a week before, on April 25th, the day his father had charged him with defending Harley. It was the first time Jacob had ever been inside the forbidding county jail, with its thick brick walls and barred windows. There had been a raft of drunk and disorderly arrests, the flood having unleashed extremities of passion, normally encountered only on Independence Day, and the place was full of bellowing drunks. Irritated by the caterwauling, the jailer, a scowl of a man named Charles Behan, did not respond to Jacob's questions about Harley's health as he led Jacob down a dank central corridor lined with solid steel doors. The gloomy passageway was lit only by a single candle at either end. The jailer carried a third. After unlocking Harley's cell, Behan handed Jacob his stub of candle, then locked him in with Harley, retreating back down the hallway in semi-darkness. The dingy cell was windowless, with only a narrow, louvered slit in the steel door. At the outer limits of his candle's flame, Jacob spied Harley snoring on the bare wooden bench that served as a bed. Even on the warm afternoon, the thermometer outside City Hall had read 72 degrees, the cell was chilly. Roaches scurried underfoot, dispersing into cracks in the brick flooring. Jacob nudged Harley with the toe of one boot, and Harley swung his legs over the edge of the cot and erupted with a loud, hacking cough. Groaning, he seized the back of his neck and swore. The bandage was a dirty, wrinkled mess. Harley still wore the nightclothes he'd had on when he'd been found at the whorehouse. Jacob made a note to bring the foreman a change of clothes and handed him a blanket and a bag containing the beef sandwich he'd brought for him from home. It was odd to see the powerful Harley in this enfeebled state, grateful for even small scraps of comfort. Every memory of his father's yard from childhood included a clear image of the strapping Harley orchestrating the movements of hundreds of men and thousands of board feet from atop a tower of plywood or lumber. It was absurd to think he had committed such a terrible crime. "Has the doctor been coming to see you?" Jacob said.
"Oh, yes."
"Well, he's done a terrible job." Harley shrugged and unfolded the woolen blanket. He wrapped it around his hunched shoulders, then gingerly peeled the waxed paper from the sandwich and took an enormous bite. After quickly devouring half the sandwich, he looked up at Jacob and said,
"Are those girls really alive?"
Jacob didn't know what he had expected Harley's first words to be.
"They are."
An unguarded look of pure relief crossed Harley's face.
"Oh, thank the Lord. Where are they, then?"
"Somewhere being well taken care of."
Jacob cleared his throat.
"I need to ask you some questions."
"Are you going to defend me? Is that why you've come?"
"Father wants me to."
"Unless you prefer someone else, in which case..."
"No, you... Your father trusts you. I trust you."
Jacob let go this last hope of a reprieve with a small, ironical laugh.
"As I said, a few questions."
"I didn't kidnap them."
Harley started in, fervently brushing crumbs from his nightshirt.
"Someone just brought them to my house. I'm fond of children, you know, just like those boys I helped. I took good care of them."
"Excuse me. Emma and Claire were actually in your house?" Harley sat straight up, and this defensive posture came at the expense of his cut. He swore again and gestured toward the back of his neck, refraining from actually touching the bandage.
"You had them all that time?" Jacob said.
"I didn't have them. I told you I was taking care of them."
Harley's reasoning was incomprehensible to Jacob.
But didn't you see all the flyers that the Stips posted? Didn't you see the advertisements in the newspapers? And what about that dinner? Father brought up their deaths. Why didn't you say anything?